Have you ever heard of the Barkley Marathons? Unless you're particularly into ultramarathons, meaning marathons longer than the typical breezy walk-in-the-park race of 26 miles, you know, just that little tiny little race, or unless you're somebody familiar with the niche coverage of these events, I'm guessing you have not. Almost 40 years ago, two runners founded the Barkley Marathons, a now infamous 100-mile foot race through incredibly unforgiving terrain. And yes, it's called marathons, plural, not marathon, because the course keeps changing. Known to its many disciples as the race that eats its young, the Barkley is considered one of the most, if not the most difficult ultramarathon in the world. With 59,100 feet of climbing, it is the equivalent of climbing Mount Everest, not just once, but twice in a single continuous race. As a result of this terrain, and as a result of the marathon's bizarre and stressful rules, some of the best runners in the world have tried and failed to even make it halfway. Out of the 1,000 or so runners who have attempted the race over the years, about 20 have finished, and that's exactly how its founders want it.
Words and ideas can change the world.
I hated her, but I wanted to love my mother.
I have a dream.
I'll plead not guilty right now.
Your only chance is to leave with us.
Welcome to another edition of Time Sucks, Short Sucks. I'm Dan Cummins, and today I will be sharing the fascinating and very entertaining story of the Barkley Marathons. We don't usually cover sporting events here, but I think you're going to quickly understand why the Barkley Marathons is definitely right up our weird, well, that's certainly something cool I didn't know about alley. Since 1986, people have from all over the world come for the chance to annihilate their minds and bodies. In a 60 hours or less, you have to do it in no longer than 60 hours, 100 miles sleepless, nearly impossible trek through the merciless wilderness of Tennessee's Frozen Head State Park. Often lost and alone, they have struggled through hallucinations, extreme cold, sometimes too much heat, thunderstorms, little minor flooding, sleet, rock bottom exhaustion. Not because somebody made them do this, but because for some reason they wanted to do this. It's a masochist dream. Indeed, it is nearly impossible to figure out how to even enter the Barkley, much less finish it. And still, around 800 people apply each year. Or that's how many people have been applying recently, I guess. When I asked the internet, how do I apply to run in the Barkley Marathon? I got a pretty interesting answer. Quote, the Barkley Marathon's application is famously secretive, requiring you to find the race director Lazarus Lake's email by researching past runners, blogs, and forums. Then sending a letter explaining why you should run, an essay, a small fee, for example, $1.60, and often your license plate or another specific item. Acceptance is not a lottery, but is based on Laz's whim. Love it. So who the hell would come up with this weird fucking race? In 1978, Gary Cantrell, later to become known as Lazarus Lake, the name he currently goes by for racing at least, was an accounting student at Middle Tennessee State University. Gary's early years were marked by some instability. Maybe he has been notoriously elusive, secretive about his biography. No one seems to even know his exact age. It seems his dad had a good career as an aerospace engineer, but new contracts required that the family uproot itself a fair amount, and Gary's father eventually got a job at, Tullahoma, Tennessee, where the family settled down. And then at some point in his youth, the running bug bit him. And by the late 70s, Gary was a tough marathon runner with 8 finishes to his name. He even finished one marathon after shotgun pellets struck him in the legs. That's right, he got shot with a shotgun while running a marathon. That clearly wasn't the Boston Marathon. This was some real country backwoods shit. Apparently, there were some hunters in the nearby woods shooting quail, and they seemed to feel that the runners were impeding on their hunting, and therefore, if they got some pellets, well, so be it. Gary was undeterred. He loved the rush, the challenge of trying to finish a marathon. But then soon as he, finished more marathons, it wasn't exciting anymore. It wasn't enough of a challenge. He was getting bored. He wanted something, you know, new and harder to complete. And he wasn't the only person feeling this. In the mid-1970s, runners across the country, elite runners, were looking for the next big thing to conquer. And they found it in an unlikely place to begin with, a horse race. I love this. I love this whole story. The Western States 100, aka the Western States Endurance Run now, considered the ultramarathon trail race even today, started off as a horse race. It was created in 1955 by Wendell T. Robey, who wanted to prove that horses could still cover 100 miles in a day, even in the modern era. In 1971 and again in 1972, a young man named Gordy Ainsley crossed the finish line on his crossbred horse Rebel. Then on his third attempt, 1973, Gordy rode another crossbreed, Rattlenose, who went lame and had to be pulled out at 29 miles. For the following year, the 27-year-old Gordy decided he wanted to redo. And Drusilla Barner, that is quite a name, the Western States Trail Foundation secretary, made Gordy an interesting proposition. Would he want to try and run this course on foot? Gordy was intrigued. And the more he thought about it, the more excited he got. And the more it made sense to him that, I can do this horse race without a horse. He figured he'd only have to run, 4.2 miles an hour to finish, an easy 14-minute, 17-second mile pace. Plus, he knew he could handle the distance since he'd already run the Castle Rock 50 miles in 1973. That same year, the 6'4", 203-pound, probably almost no body fat Gordy finished the Avenue of the Giants Marathon through the Redwood Forest in Northern California in 2 hours and 52 minutes. Average marathon time is around 4.5 hours. My God, the dude's a beast, making me feel bad about my fitness level. I get winded on a flight of stairs, as in like, 2 floors and more. I'm giving myself too much credit. one floor, and I'm a little bit like, whew, oh man, those stairs, whew, gosh dang. This dude could have probably carried me like a baby up 99 flights of stairs and then have me walk up the 100th flight, alongside him, and somehow I would be more winded than he was. I looked him up, and at the age of 78, he is still running, doing a 10K Cool Yule Jingle Jog this Christmas morning, according to his website. If you're a space lizard and get this episode a little bit early, you'll have just enough time to join him. You can join him running down the Bear River Canal Recreation Corridor in Meadow Vista, California. Just show up and pay $45. Just look it up to get more info. Go meet Care Bear. Back to the 1970s, Gordy's experience participating in the Ride and Tie, a trail running / horseback riding relay race, prepared him for the trail's extreme terrain and elevation changes. And so he felt like, why not try it and see? Try and run a 100-mile race designed for horses. What's the worst that could happen? His legs could break off, bleeds out in the woods, his lungs explode. The night before the race, Gordy climbed into his friend Diane Ripley's horse trailer parked near the start. He would be the only runner in this race. Diane was competing too, but with her horse, Valentina. I love that he just sleeps a little bit in the horse trailer. That's normal. A little after 3:30 in the morning, Gordy gets up, slips on some cut-off pantyhose, protection against painful chafing. To keep the ends of the pantyhose from rolling up, he wraps white athletic tape around each thigh. Just MacGyvering the shit, just figuring it out as he goes along. He pulled on yellow shorts and a makeshift bib. The number 0 was handwritten above WSTR with black Sharpie on a white cotton shirt. And at 4:50 a.m. in the morning, it's go time. For the first few miles of the race, Gordy speed walked uphill out of Squaw Valley, mostly on a graded service road for the ski lifts. Then around mile 4, the path narrowed to a single track. There was nowhere to step aside to let the horses pass. So Gordy now ran single file along with the horses at their trotting pace, roughly 7 minutes and 30 seconds per mile. And he did that for over 20 miles. 25 miles into the race, this pace had Gordy exhausted. He's desperately looking forward to the meeting point he'd established with his friend Helen now. She was going to be waiting with a fresh pair of shoes, some Adidas Gazelles, which were more cushioned than the lightly padded Adidas SL72s he had chosen for the first third of the race. But when he made it to Helen, she told him she wasn't able to find the shoes in her camper, or his camper. So damn it, Helen, you had one job and you fucked it. Gordy would have to keep going with what he'd come with, which included 2 packets of powdered electrolyte replacement with glucose, known to runners as ERG. He rationed the powder, sprinkling it into his mouth with mouthfuls of water from a creek that was running nearby. So that's risky, drinking some creek water. That's gambling. Sounds like a good way to end up having to tap out of the race thanks to explosive, crippling diarrhea. Guess it was a clean creek. But also, maybe not. Gordy is clearly superhuman. He's got some of that Compound V in him, if you know that reference. Soon, however, the land turned dry, and he had to rely on the water given out at aid stations placed sporadically on the trail. Probably guessing that water was mostly for the horses. All he had to eat was a can of peaches. He had bummed off a communications team along the course. Why did they have a can of peaches? Since the aid stations only offered water, hay, and grain, you know, for the horses. By the time he reached mile 50, he was suffering. And he wasn't the only one. A horse, one of his competitors, had collapsed in the middle fork of the American River, and Gordy had stopped to help it, but the horse was unresponsive. It was evident to Gordy that the horse was dying. Its life force had been sapped by the strenuous climb, the thin air, and the 100-degree heat. This is crazy. Despite the obvious danger, Gordy kept running. Anyone else flashing on Forrest Gump for some reason? Soon as he started running the Devil's Thumb, an 1,800-foot ascent over 1.8 miles, Gordy was worried about his own life force. By the time he got to the peak and saw his friend Diane Ripley sitting under the ponderosa pine trees, he was convinced that it was too much. "There's a dead horse in the canyon, and that could be me," Gordy told her. He said he was going to quit, but Diane gave him some water and 4 salt tablets. Then she had him flip over onto his stomach, and she walked up and down his knotted body and massaged his legs. Who are these people? When she was done, he figured, you know what? I can give it another shot. By the time Gordy entered the fairgrounds, end of the race, at 4:32 a.m., he'd been running for 23 hours and 42 minutes, just a few minutes shy of an entire day. That is crazy. He did it. He ran 100 miles over mountainous terrain, fueled mainly by canned peaches and creek water. After he finished, he removed his shoes, saw deep blood blisters across the soles of his feet, but for him, the pain was nothing compared to the high of becoming the first man to run the Western States 100. And his journey would inspire others to follow him. 4 years later, 1978, 62 runners would toe the starting line of the Western States 100, including Gary Ansley, ready for another shot at achieving the impossible. 30 of them, just under half, would actually finish the race, Gordy amongst them. But he didn't try and rely on Helen again to hand him fresh shoes. Now, to be clear, it's not like Gordy was the first human to ever complete such a grueling foot race. There were definitely long marathons before Gordy's time, going back to races in ancient Sparta and Greece and elsewhere, I'm sure. But this was one of the first that made American media coverage and attracted the attention of runners nationwide. Runners like Gary Cantrell over in Tennessee. But Gary still wanted something even more challenging. He didn't want to run a race that someone else had laid out. He wanted to design one himself, a tougher one. In 1979, he and his fellow Horse Mountain Runners, which was the name of a club of crazy-ass runners he'd helped found, created their own ultra to run. It was called the Strollin' Jim, and the 40-mile run took place in War Trace, Tennessee. It was named after a famed horse that became one of the oldest yearly ultras in the country. And there's a plaque in town today that describes that old horse. Says, "Strollin' Jim, the first world's champion Tennessee walking horse, is buried in a pasture directly behind the Walking Horse Hotel. Foaled in 1936, this former workhorse was ridden to the championship by Floyd Carruthers at the first walking horse celebration at Shelbyville in 1939. Jim died in 1957 in the pasture where he spent his last years. The first Strollin' Jim race was a success. Also wasn't quite what Gary expected. What surprised Gary wasn't that people showed up, it was who showed up. He would later say, 6 or 8 doctors were in the race. That sort of surprised me. You'd think of all people, they'd know better." That got Gary thinking, was there a race so insane, so stupid, that nobody would do it? Or by making that kind of race, was he destined to attract the craziest of the crazies, the extreme beast mode ultra marathoners like Gordy Ansley? In 1981, Gary put together a race called the Idiot's Run in Shelbyville, Tennessee, consisting of 76 miles and 37 significant hills. And once again, people showed up. A dozen runners made it to the starting line of the Idiot's Run. Exactly 2 finished. The rest, beat to shit and half dead, tapped out. Despite how obviously grueling this race was, it wasn't grueling enough for Gary. He wanted something harder. He wanted something that he expected literally no one to be able to finish. He didn't want to make it literally impossible, I should say, but just like not quite, but he wanted to make it very close to impossible. I love this fucking maniac. The next year, 1982, he extended the Idiot's course length to a whopping 108 miles, and he eliminated literally every flat section. Nothing but hills and mountains. Dude's a sadist. The objective wasn't so much to see who finished. In fact, if they did, Gary would be very disappointed. He just wanted to see how far the toughest runners in the country could make it before they gave up. Gary was confident that this was, quote, the grimmest race in the world. But remarkably, 6 of the 12 starters finished that year. The winner making it to the end with a comfortable time of 17 hours, 43 minutes, and 45 seconds. How? So it wasn't that hard. Cantrell needed to up the ante again. He wanted to make it better. By better, of course, he meant harder, more painful, more sadistic. So he did, extending the distance to somewhere around 120 miles. In 1984, 8 runners signed up that year. Not sure how many finished, but however many did, very likely too many for Gary. Now Gary began looking further afield. He didn't want to keep making the race longer and longer. I mean, that was the easy way, of course, to make it, you know, impossible eventually. He wanted to design a course where the terrain was much more challenging. Soon, he would find the exact kind of challenging geography he was looking for. The future home of the Barkley Marathons would be Frozen Head State Park near Wartburg, Tennessee, in the Cumberland Mountains. Wartburg. It's quite a name. Not actually named after warts, unfortunately. Named after Wartburg, or I guess it'd be Wartburg Castle in Germany, where Martin Luther translated the New Testament and parts of the Old Testament into German. The Cumberland Mountains are composed mainly of Pennsylvanian-age sedimentary rocks, sandstone, shale, siltstone, coal seams, laid down roughly 300 million years ago when the region was part of a vast coastal plain and swamp system. Over eons, the Appalachian orogeny, a fancy geology term for the mountain building period caused by continental collisions, uplifted this plateau with rock layers alternating between resistant sandstone caps and softer shale, which erodes faster, creating the dramatic cliffs, ledges, and drainage hollows that are, you know, brutal to walk on, much less run. Pre-European colonization, this area was the ancestral hunting grounds of the Cherokee. Settlers who arrived in the 1800s generally did not attempt to make their homes in the unforgiving mountains. They favored the Emory River bottomlands, and nearby Wartburg, which was founded in the 1840s as a German community. Although businesses occasionally purchased land in the Frozen Head area for its natural resources, throughout the 19th century, the area remained largely undisturbed, unpopulated, until the state of Tennessee purchased 13,000 acres of it in 1894. The state's plan was simple. With coal miners staging strikes and companies asking the state to intervene, why not cut out the middleman and get into the coal business themselves? And why not do it with prison labor? Before we go any further, time for this week's first of two Mid-Show sponsor breaks. If you don't want to hear these ads, please sign up to be a Spacesizzler on Patreon. Get the catalog ad-free, get these episodes early and more. Thanks for listening to those ads, and now let's return to the 1890s to talk about the construction of a prison in an area so rugged and punishing, Gary Cantrell will just have to route a race through it. Indeed, inmates were used to build the prison itself, Brushy Mountain Prison, a four-story wooden structure. The natural formation of the mountain on three sides surrounding the prison meant that escape was virtually impossible. There was one way in and one way out. If they wanted to leave, inmates would have to pass through the town of Petros, Tennessee, where lawmen would likely find them and eagerly bring them back to collect a nice bounty. Of course, the other option was to go over the mountain, but few would try. If you decided, you know, to tough your sentence out, you were awakened each day at 5:45 a.m. by a whistle and quickly given some shitty breakfast. Then you'd be marched up a steep hill into the mines, carrying your lunch pail with you so you wouldn't need to go back to the prison and waste valuable time. You'd work until 4:45 p.m., a shift of almost 12 straight hours. These were 12 dangerous, difficult hours, and there were often injuries and fatalities. But that didn't matter to those at the top. In 1900, the mines would bring in more than $175,000, or somewhere around $7 million in today's money. And 6 years later, the governor at the time, Malcolm Rice Patterson, reported that he was delighted with the operation. He wrote, "The Brushy Mountain mines are in more prosperous and profitable condition than ever before in our history. More coal is being mined. Shipments are larger and more prompt, and prices are better, while expenses are relatively less than ever before. It costs the people just as much to keep the prisoners in idleness as it does to keep them at work. Unless profitably employed, they would be an enormous burden on the state." Within just a few decades, though, the inmates had had enough. Though there wasn't much they could do from inside the prison, once they got out, they started writing articles about how terrible the conditions were, how dangerous the work was. including a 1932 campaign that described how 900 miners would work all day only to spend their nights in overcrowded, disease-ridden cells. An investigating committee would agree, reporting that, quote, conditions at the state's Brushy Mountain prison at Petros approach conditions which prevailed in the Siberian prisons under the old Russian regime. What's more, the 35-year-old wooden structure was, quote, a dangerous fire hazard. One commissioner called it, quite directly, one of the worst things in the state. So in 1934, construction of a new facility began. This new facility would be made of sandstone from a nearby quarry. Of course, the people who built it were inmates, right? Why waste all that free labor? After the structure, which was designed to look like a Christian cross, was finished in 1935, the prison population swelled to over 1,000 men. And now practically no one attempted a classic walk-off-the-grounds escape, which, as we've learned in previous episodes, was actually somewhat common back then in a lot of prisons. Instead, prisoners here focused their escape routes on the mines, like an incident that took place on March 27th, 1938, when 38 prisoners discovered a soft seam of coal about a mile and a half into the mine. In this coal seam, the prisoners dug a 30-foot shaft, then used dynamite to blast their way up and out onto the mountain slope. That's wild. When the alarm was sounded the next morning, posses of guards, civilians, and bloodhounds began to comb the woods, and eventually 17 men were returned to their cells. At least some returned of their own accord after struggling with the hostile landscape. By the next day, 12 more men were captured. Two escapees made it through the backcountry and into Kentucky, but hungry, tired, and depleted, they were soon captured too. At the end of the manhunt, a mere 6 men were still on the loose, and at the end of the month, one of the 6 surrendered in Denver, admitting that he was hungry, broke, and tired of dodging the law. That was how tough this terrain was. It beat the will to survive out of you. And that reputation soon meant that the men who filled the prison cells were tough, violent, and cruel, men who could not risk containment anywhere else. Eventually, it wasn't the mining accidents, the violence, including a time when some prisoner tied dynamite to a fellow inmate and literally blew off his arms and legs, or the riots that finally convinced the state to shut down the coal mining operation. It was simply that by the mid-1960s, coal mining had become a lot less profitable. The prison itself wouldn't close officially until 2009, and in the meantime, an event took place that would ultimately inspire the Barkley Marathons. On April 4th, 1968, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was fatally wounded by a sniper's bullet while standing on the balcony outside his second-story room at the Motel Lorraine in Memphis. That evening, a Remington 30-06 hunting rifle was found on the sidewalk beside a rooming house, just a block from the Lorraine Motel. During the next several weeks, the rifle, eyewitness reports, and fingerprints on the weapon all implicated a single suspect, escaped convict James Earl Ray. In May of 1968, a massive manhunt for Ray began. The FBI eventually determined that he had obtained a Canadian passport under a false identity, a surprisingly easy thing to do at the time. On June 8th, Scotland Yard investigators arrested Ray at a London airport. Ray was trying to fly to Belgium with the eventual goal, he later admitted, of reaching Rhodesia, a country that would become Zimbabwe. Extradited to the U.S., Ray stood before a Memphis judge in March 1969 and pled guilty to King's murder, mainly to avoid the electric chair. He was sentenced to 99 years in prison, and that prison would be, of course, Brushy Mountain. James Earl Ray walked through the gates of Brushy Mountain for the first time on March 21, 1970, though to the outside world, he insisted that he was a patsy in a larger conspiracy that involved some handler named Raoul. Inside the prison, he stayed pretty quiet. He'd give only one interview to News Sentinel reporter Willard Yarborough, in March 1971 to, quote, "Let people outside know that I wasn't crazy," as he put it. "I do not cause trouble here," Ray told him. "I work 6 hours a day, 7 days a week. I write memos to my lawyer. I'm in bed and asleep by 8 every night. Just another prisoner, and I'm treated as one." If he was a model prisoner, as he claimed to be, there was a chance he could have qualified for parole in 34 years, that is, at the age of 73, but Ray didn't want to wait nearly that long. In May of 1970, barely 3 months in, he used a stolen hacksaw, chisel, and crowbar. How did he get all that stuff so quickly? To punch a hole into his cell wall and jimmy his way into a steam tunnel that led to the outside. Unfortunately for him, that steam tunnel was pretty hot. He didn't actually fully make it in because it was 400 degrees. So he didn't escape. Instead, he got 30 days in the hole. 9 months later, he saw another opportunity. This time, Ray tried to bore his way out through the ceiling. That attempt, not successful either, gets in more trouble. Finally would leave Brushy in July of 1972, but not the way he wanted to. An armed convoy carried Ray to the Tennessee State Prison in Nashville after Brushy was temporarily closed. 4 years later, in August of 1976, the prison reopened, renovated to serve as the maximum security housing for Tennessee's worst offenders, and the celebrity inmate returned by his own request. Like the first time, he tried to fashion himself as a model inmate, and he soon went to work in the prison laundry, where his good attitude gained him some privileges. By the spring of 1977, the national spotlight had turned on Ray again. Investigators for the House Select Committee on Assassinations visited Petros no fewer than four times to question Ray behind closed doors about what he claimed to know. His attorney at the time, Jack Kershaw, held out hope that the probe could lead to a new trial, but the committee decided not to bring Ray to Washington to testify. Once again, his case is dead in the water. With that, normal operations at the prison resumed, and Friday, June 9th, seemed like any other summer day at the prison. That evening, Floyd Hooks sat at his post in the guard tower along Brushy Mountain's north wall, looking out at the vast expanse of green wilderness as inmates milled around the yard below. Floyd was in one of nine towers that stood along the prison's walls, but only eight held guards. The last tower was a tacked-on wooden addition near the corner where the northeast wall met the bare rock of the mountain slope. Normally, it stayed empty, except during riots or other emergencies. The wall beside the tower stood 12 feet high, topped by barbed wire electrified with 2,300 volts. At the spot where the mountain and the wall met, the wire tilted upward, leaving an 18-inch gap, just barely big enough for a skinny-grown man to maybe squeeze beneath. On the opposite side, some 40 years of erosion had built up a mound of dirt that could cushion a drop of about 12 feet. At 7:30 p.m., five men broke away from the basketball court, the softball diamond and the horseshoe stakes. Huddling near the empty tower, they pulled pieces of pipe out from under their shirts, out from under their waistbands, from behind rocks and clumps of dirt that lined the fence that had been, you know, obviously they'd been hidden there earlier. And then somebody near the basketball court threw a punch and a fight broke out, drawing Floyd's attention. As Floyd turned, sections of pipe came together into a rudimentary 12-foot ladder that swung into the air and hooked over the outside edge of the northeast wall, just where the electrified wire ended. This is genius. James Earl Ray scrambled up and over first. I guess this was his plan. Then Larry Edward Hacker, a convicted bank robber from West Tennessee's Hardin County, followed. After him was Earl Hill Jr., serving two life sentences for rape and murder outside of Irwin, Tennessee, and Donald Ray Kaler, a Knoxville convict, serving time for armed robbery and attempted murder. Rounding out the back was Doug Shelton, a killer from Kingsport, with a long record of escaping from jails and prisons. Each ran the moment they hit the ground, of course. And then there was one more, David Lee Powell, a fellow killer from Shelby County, also served a 99-year sentence, looked out the window from the prison dining hall, and to his surprise, saw a bunch of dudes escaping, just climbing up over a makeshift ladder. He's like, I want in. So he ran downstairs, ran out the door in time to reach the ladder, just as the last man scampered up and over. On his heels then came Jerry Ward, a bank robber from Shelby County, who had Powell's same idea. They're like, awesome, thanks guys for setting this up. The setting sun then struck Powell's white kitchen uniform as he dashed across the yard, and the glare caught the eye of Linwood Butler, another guard monitoring the opposite wall. Linwood cocked his shotgun and opened fire. Floyd Hooks, the nearest guard to the escape point, though he would never get off a shot, he later testified he tripped over his rifle, fell against the tower door, accidentally shut it and locked himself inside. Guessing he just got a little bit of shit over that. Probably got himself a new job pretty soon. One of Butler's shots caught Jerry Ward, the last man up the ladder, as he crossed the wall. Ward tumbled to the ground, bleeding from his head and his arm. Guards caught up with him minutes later. Ward would leave the prison grounds in an ambulance, shouting as the paramedics hustled him out, James Earl Ray got out! James Earl Ray got out! What a fucking dickhead. Because he couldn't escape, he didn't want other people escaping. Indeed, Ray couldn't have chosen better timing. Stoney Lay, the warden, had left town to visit his sister in Texas. And though Ray couldn't have anticipated it, his notoriety would protect him. There were so many calls made, both from the prison and the nearby towns, that the whole telephone system of Morgan County crashed, rendering lawmakers unable to mobilize. As prison officials consulted on the best course of action, tried to deny the rumors that somebody inside had helped Ray escape, the media began to arrive. Reporters, photographers, and cameramen swarmed the gates, from as close as the Morgan County News as far away as correspondents from the New York Times and across the pond at the BBC. Sensing an impending national crisis, President Jimmy Carter ordered the FBI to step in and take over the manhunt, though local law enforcement and the governor, Ray Blanton, who would resign 2 years later and then head to prison himself for a couple years for selling liquor licenses. One of the most corrupt, officials in history over there, insisted the state could do it all on their own. With so much confusion and dueling law enforcement agencies, it seemed unlikely that any of the convicts would ever be found. But of course, there was the unforgiving terrain around them to deal with. How long could these guys last in the wilds of Tennessee? Not very long, as it turned out. David Powell, the kitchen helper, who spotted his chance to run, gave himself up on Saturday afternoon after a police helicopter spotted him hiding in an open field off of State Highway 62 near Frozen Head State Park. Didn't even last 24 hours. He swore he didn't know about the escape plot, said he had no idea where to find Ray and the others. Sunday morning would bring another capture. Larry Hacker was found kneeling inside a one-room church 4 miles from the prison in a town known as New River across the Anderson County line. A thunderstorm on Sunday ended the search effort, but around 10:30 p.m., a team caught up with Earl Hill on a hillside not far from the New River Church. He gave himself up, asked politely for a cigarette. But their golden goose, still out there, James Earl Ray. Luckily, a New River resident would call to report seeing these three strangers traveling in the dark. One matched Ray's description. A searcher suspected the men must have split up when they reached the highway, and soon the area was inundated with law enforcement groups, agents, officers, state troopers, and bloodhounds. And it was the dogs who would do the real work. Across the railroad track, through the river, up the mountain, into the briars and the brush, the dogs scampered ahead, trailing a scent. 1 hour turned into two, then three. They crossed an old logging road into more woods. Still, the dogs didn't stop until they finally did. Around 2 a.m., a bloodhound named Sandy came to a halt. Another dog named Little Red came to a halt behind her. They were standing in front of a shadowy form half covered with leaves, and it was James Earl Ray. He crawled to his feet, and then he was led downhill to the road where the warden waited. He had little more than $100 cash in his pockets and a piece of a map. They got him. Just like law enforcement had suspected, the convicts had split up, and Ray and two companions initially went almost straight to the slope of Frozen Head, a climb of nearly 2,000 feet. His strategy was to travel during the night as much as he could, then hide during the day. Not a bad strategy, considering police helicopters were swarming the area. With Ray's recapture, the media coverage died down. Crews camped outside the prison, they were camped out there, were packing up now, some decamping moments after his return to solitary confinement. A few months later, however, Ray would be interviewed about his few hours of freedom. And of the terrain, he would say, "That's wilderness out there. I must have been in places that no human being has ever been. There's heavy brush up here and things like that." He continued, "There are a lot of cliffs with ledges on them. You can sit under the ledges. There are coal mines up there, but it would be foolish getting into one of those things. That's usually what they shake down first." Drenching rain had slowed him down on the second day, and he added that he wasn't happy about being run down, but the hunger really kind of dulls your emotions in some ways. This particular story would captivate Gary Cantrell. Despite having almost two full days, James Earl Ray had only made it about 8 miles. Of course, this was due to numerous factors, right? The need to hide and travel by night, the ongoing search, the thunderstorm, the harsh landscape. Gary focused on the harsh landscape. He thought this place sounded perfect for what he had in mind. And before I lay out exactly what Gary had in mind, time for today's second of two mid-show sponsor breaks. Thanks for listening to our sponsors. Now let's return and go over how Gary began to build the race that eats its own young. In 1985, Gary and his friend Carl Henn, soon to be known to ultramarathoners as Raw Dog, and co-founder of the Barkley, went up into that same wilderness with the intention to hike in 2 days the 20-mile-long boundary trail that ran along some of Ray's route. When the men showed the Rangers their map, they were told they wouldn't be able to make it, and to not even try, because the Rangers didn't want to have to rescue them. But Gary and Carl managed to convince them that they could do it, and the men set off. It was a grueling, punishing trail, and the first 7.5 miles took a full 10 hours. The area they covered was both stunning and bleak. The ground striated in flat limestone, sandstone, shale, and coal, the bare branches of trees and spiderwebs stark in the weak sunlight. Dense thickets forced them to either change their path or plow through the underbrush, and the brittle sticks and slick leaves underfoot were a constant hazard. In essence, it was nothing like the vistas and verdant forests that were usually the locations for ultramarathoners, pushing the runners ahead with the promise of stunning views and beautiful natural scenes. Instead, it was brutal, harsh, and unforgiving. The the kind of place where you couldn't let your mind wander or try to zone out to dull the pain you were feeling from running so damn far. Or the way Gary thought of it, it was the perfect place for his kind of ultramarathon. The first Barkley would take place there March 1st, 1986. And now you might be asking, who the hell's Barkley? Well, the race was named after one of Cantrell's early running partners, Barry Barkley, a man who was sadly badly injured in Vietnam and could no longer run, but he still kept up with the ultramarathon circuit. So, you know, named in his honor, which is very cool. For the early years, the race was somewhere between 50 and 55 miles with about 25 to 27,000 feet of climbing, and it had a 24-hour cutoff. 13 unlucky runners would be the course's first victims, including Cantrell himself. They all had to pay an entry fee of 35 cents. Three runners arrived late, went up the wrong mountain, which meant they were out before they even had the chance to experience any real pain. The others began the trek an hour before dawn, began tackling the difficult north section about 12 miles in. As Gary would later describe that area, it is poorly marked, severely eroded, overgrown, and laced with deadfalls. So, you know, sounds super fun. There was no guarantee that once you had gotten over an obstacle, there wouldn't simply be more obstacles in your path. After all, it was raw nature, not a groomed course. In that first year, Cantrell and his friend Gary Buffington came to a pile of tree trunks, stopped while they figured out how to get across a steep hillside without injuring themselves. And Cantrell had an idea there. He told Buffington to give him his pack. Then Cantrell just took both packs and just yeeted them over the pile of tree trunks. Shrugging, he then told Buffington, "Now we have to get there." And they did. They made it across. Two runners ended up completing the first 20-mile loop in under 9 hours, and then wisely they chose to quit. Three other runners got lost, hopped in the so-called quitter's jeep for a ride back to the starting point in shame. Three remained. Buffington and Cantrell finished the first loop in 12 hours and 18 minutes, and then they called it two. Only Damon Douglas continued on, reaching around 37 miles in, just over 17 hours. But he knew he couldn't finish the last 20 miles by the 24-hour cutoff, so he decided to just give up and stop there. So there were no finishers for that year's Barkley. And Gary Cantrell called it, quote, a rousing success all around. There may have been another reason why nobody finished. Some would say that the course was actually a lot longer than Cantrell had claimed it was. Gary was and is known to be a devious trickster in the ultramarathon community. Still, Gary maintained that he had simply given the runners a tough course and they weren't up to task and they failed. In an Ultra Running Magazine report, he wrote, "Of course, it is still impossible to run 50 miles on a trail in a day, but if anyone wants to try, we'll be doing it again next spring." For the next year, Gary spread the word about his insane race at other marathons. 16 runners would show up for the second year, 1987. That year saw the first woman to run the Barkley Marathon, Linda Sledge. Linda, like the others, had simply called Cantrell to sign up, since there wasn't any formalized registration. They would pay a new entry fee that year, a whopping 50 cents, one for each mile. Cheekily, Cantrell offered a, quote, full refund if you stick it out and have a cubic inch of your body not in extreme pain. That same year, his goofy newspaper advertisements managed to draw the attention of a celebrity in the ultramarathon world, Tom Possert. Possert, a native of Cincinnati, Ohio, had started a sort of ultramarathon early in his life. As a kid, he and his friends would go on 100-mile-long bike rides. In high school, he switched focus, started to run track, but soon found out that he hated being lapped and he quit. He wasn't that fast, but he was tough. He couldn't outlap you, but he could run a whole lot more laps than you. In college, Possert would discover that the longer he ran, the more distance he covered and the more competitive he got. He ended up running his first 50-mile ultramarathon in 1984, Chicago's AMJA Ultra, and he finished at a speed of 8 hours and 34 minutes. That's fucking crazy. He ran just over a 10-minute mile for 50 miles. Following year, he ran the JFK 50, finished 18th at 7 hours and 40 minutes. Now he's running closer to a 9-minute mile for 50 straight miles. 1986, he ran 147 miles at the across-the-year 6-day marathon, which was at the time the fifth furthest distance for any American ultramarathoner. Jesus Christ. Don't have a time for that one, but who cares? It's just cool that he ran 147 miles. Safe to say, everyone thought that if anybody could finish the Barkley, it was Possert. He would arrive a few days early before April 11th to hike the area's trails, get a feel for the course, which included a new 1.25-mile climb to the top of Frozen Head. In total, the course now consisted of three 16 2/3 mile loops with a 36-hour cutoff. And when the runners assembled for the 6-minute start time, Possert and another runner immediately took the lead. Among the other runners were 5 Marines who had previously run the JFK 50 and were confident they could finish this rinky-dink race. There was also Fred Pylon, the Massachusetts-based co-editor of Ultra Running Magazine, who had competed in the Barkley the year before, but wound up running off the trail and becoming disqualified. He now returned for more punishment, and after several miles, he caught up with Possert and the other runner who was in the lead, as the three of them made their way down to the brand-new section of the course. Later, Pylon would describe the scenery as the top of the valley was guarded by dense strands of briars, blown-down trees, huge boulders, and numerous cliffs. At the base of Frozen Head, they found no trail that led to the summit, so they bushwhacked their way through. Along the way, they passed, quote, numerous seams of coal, old wells, wheels, and pulleys of all sorts in a cave. This leg of the journey took them a whopping 2 hours, though it would take others 4 hours. In the end, none of them ever found the correct trail, if it even existed. Possert and Pylon completed the first 16.7-mile loop in 7 hours. They headed out for the second loop, just as afternoon was fading into evening. The two men briefly separated, then met up later on after Possert had stopped, rested, and ate before the difficult Frozen Head section. When Pylon caught up, he asked Possert, "Do you plan to go through hell again?" Both men knew that climbing the mountain twice was too much for them, and they enjoyed their two-man loser run back to the start, having ran for a total of 14 hours and 30 minutes. The Marines did make it up Frozen Head again, but then quit soon after. The Barkley won again. No one finished. But for some reason, people would continue to try. 19 brave or foolish, depending on how you look at it, runners came in 1988, including 11 newcomers. All of them had submitted an entry form titled The Barkley Marathon, The Race That Eats Its Young. And with the increased popularity of the race, prospective runners now had to submit essays on why they should be allowed to enter, considering, as Cantrell wrote, "There is no way you'll be finishing the race." In follow-up letters, Cantrell warned the runners that Barkley would, quote, bite them in the ass. As the runners now warmed up, Cantrell handed out custom-designed race shirts that year that included a picture of a wolf, or at least a wolf-like animal, feasting on a fallen runner at the bottom of the mountain, or of a mountain. One of the year's runners was Ed Furtaugh, an ultramarathoner who had been personally invited by Cantrell. Cantrell had actually invited Furtaugh on a very different kind of mission the previous month. He wanted Furtaugh to help with the problem. How would they make sure that the runners ran the correct course? And Furtaugh came up with a unique solution. There would be several checkpoints, each one with their own book, like just a random book. Runners would be assigned a page number, say page 39, and they would have to grab the 39th page at each checkpoint from each book, you know, to complete the race. This now presented Furtaugh with an obvious advantage. He knew the course before anyone else did. He had a preview, even of the Frozen Head segment, which was now definitively known among racers as hell. Furtaugh would later describe his first time summiting the mountain. Hell is an incredibly steep ascent that goes westward straight up the side of Frozen Head Mountain. I was amazed at the steepness of the climb. We had to literally pull ourselves uphill from tree to tree in the steepest places. Never one to wish for a fair race, Cantrell advised Furtaugh to not help newcomers, to let them get lost. And then it was, pardon the expression, off to the races. Possert and a new runner, Eric Clifton, flew around the first loop. Clifton finished in 5 hours and 50 minutes, with Possert arriving just 2 minutes later. Furtaugh finished his first loop in a respectable 6 hours and 56 minutes, and returning runner Fred Pylon clocked in 8 hours. Those were the successes. Everyone else had already failed. 7 runners became confused and missed one of the checkpoints, disqualifying them. One more runner quit after hell, aka the path up to the summit of Frozen Head just beat the shit out of him. If you're keeping score, that meant that 11 runners finished the first loop, but only 6 started the second. Possert finished the loop second loop first, followed by Clifton 90 minutes later, who now decided he'd had quite enough and quit. Ed Furtaugh finished loop 2 at 15 hours and 9 minutes. However, Possert had goofed on the second loop, missing a short section to go to the top of the Frozen Head again. He made the same mistake on his third loop, cutting the course distance by a total of about a mile. Possert continued, though, not knowing that all of his effort would result in a DNF. Did not finish. At 23 hours, 47 minutes in, Possert finished his third loop as Ed Furtaugh scrambled to start on his since he'd taken a 3-hour nap. Despite being the first ever person to kind of finish the Barkley, Possert was disqualified. And apparently he took it well. Cantrell later said, "Possert's class in the face of bitter disappointment stands alone as the brightest moment that will ever be seen at the Barclay. By dawn, Fertaw was the only one left on the course. And finally, at 32 hours in, he made it to the finish line. The Barclay Marathon had its first quote-unquote winner. And now the dangers of running off the course were becoming widely known, especially when Cantrell published his write-up of that year's marathon. The runner cannot afford to lapse into a semi-comatose state of pure running and suffering, Cantrell warned. Failure to stay alert for even a moment can lead to a wander off the trail, and finding it again can be quite difficult. The question on everyone's mind now was, would Cantrell make the course even harder because someone had beat it? Of course he would. Cantrell announced that for 1989, he would introduce 1,000 rattlesnakes, 100 hungry wolves, 50 psychopaths with flamethrowers riding motorcycles, given the green light to kill anyone on sight. Okay, maybe not that. That'd be exciting. But it would be harder. Now there would be a 100-mile option with 50,000 feet of, quote, wonderful climbing with a 50-hour cutoff. To Cantrell, this made perfect sense. After all, he said, 2 miles per hour ain't much. I'm sure there are plenty of real runners out there who believe they can do it. We'll see. I love these taunts, these guys. This race would be held appropriately on April Fool's Day. Besides having both a long one and a short one, there was also the addition of Rat Jaw, a new major climb on each loop that went up the south face of Frozen Head, which remained in the race until 1994. Hell and Rat Jaw. Awesome. In 1988, only 14 runners started the race. Nora Hen Fisher became the first woman to finish the first loop. But nobody, man or woman, made it even halfway through that year's Barclay. 29 runners would run 2 years later, 1990, paying the increased race fee of $1.55. One of them was David Horton, an ultramarathoner whose slowest time on a 100-mile course up to that point was 22 hours and 5 minutes. Dude's another beast. Surely if anyone could finish the 100-mile Barclay, he could, right? Ed Fertaw also returned along with Eric Clifton, Frozen Ed, I guess a nickname for Ed Fertaw, led the pack but then quit after Loop 2. Horton, Clifton, and another runner were the only ones to start Loop 3, and they all finished together at 26 hours, 22 minutes. Then it was time for Loop 4, but none of them made it all the way to the end. A whopping 6 loops. The 50-mile 3-loop version would eventually become known as the Fun Run and got to be surprisingly achievable. There were 10 finishers in 91, 2 in 92, 11 in 93, and 1 in 94. In 1995, the course would be changed, with the loops increased to 20 miles and a full run being 5 20-mile loops, or, you know, 100 miles. That year, Tom Posser was the first to complete the 60-mile fun run and bowed out. I love how it's always just shifting, like the distance and everything. Somebody else ran the first full 100-mile Barclay Marathon. His name was Mark Williams, and he finished it in 59 minutes. He finished it in an hour. Oh, goddamn, he was fast. He had a jetpack, which gave him a huge advantage. No, he finished it in 59 hours, 28 minutes, 48 seconds, making it to the end about a half an hour before the cutoff. By 2013, only 14 had ever completed the full distance. Most of them engineers, chemists, and physicists. People with advanced degrees, high achievers who loved a challenge. By this time, Gary Cantrell was going by Lazarus Lake now. And how did he arrive at that name? Well, he found it in a phone book. He just looked at a phone book in the middle of an ultramarathon at some point in the around this time, thought it sounded cool and unique, adopted it as a now iconic nickname in the ultra-running world, adding it to his mysterious persona. Why was he looking through a phone book in the middle of a race? Who knows? Not a lot makes sense with this guy. This dude lives somewhere between eccentric and batshit. Lazarus had stopped publicizing his marathon by this point. He no longer needed to. For one thing, it had become quite popular, and for another, it was against the spirit of the race to be helpful to those who wanted to compete. People who have business out there on the Barclay find out how to enter, Lake said in an interview. That's the whole race. Nothing is done to make it mentally easier. The race dates are not posted. There's no website. Sweet Jesus. Why do I love this guy so much? This dude reminds me of the dude who ran Action Park. In the spirit, runners now had to complete an entry form with some interesting questions. Here are some that have shown up on past forms. What is the most important vegetable group? What will be the 199th element on the periodic table? Write the Gettysburg Address in Save, which is a mythological Chinese script. After this, 40 runners are selected. That's the current limit. Historically, if accepted, a runner receives a letter of condolence that warns them they have, quote, a very bad thing waiting. In other letters, Lake has said that a runner's participation in the Barclay will, quote, amount to nothing more than an extended period of unspeakable suffering, at the end of which you will ultimately find only failure and humiliation. They can spend the months before the race training, he writes, but that time would be better spent putting their affairs in order. He's written, update your will, visit with friends and relatives, and otherwise tie up any loose ends. You might still escape by simply writing me and asking that your slot be passed along to some other unfortunate fool. Cantrell also picks at least one, quote, human sacrifice every year, a person he believes truly has zero chance of finishing the race. Virgins or new competitors have had to bring a set of license plates from their home state or county, or country as a first-time entry fee, along with $1.60. Previous racers have had to bring Lake something he needs for his personal use, but doesn't feel like getting himself, stuff like flannel shirts, pairs of socks. In 2016, it was, quote, a cool t-shirt with foreign writing on it. Who is this guy? Anyone who's finished the race before also has to bring Lake a pack of Camel cigarettes. Did I mention this ultra marathon runner smokes? Yeah, he does. For at least around 20 years, the race has begun with Lake lighting a cigarette. Runners waiting to start. They camp out near the base of the mountain. As everyone settles into their campsites, the atmosphere turns festive. Chicken thighs marinate in barbecue sauce, sizzle on the grill all night. Industrial-sized cans of baked beans set on stumps brought by the runners, you know, like potluck style. Sometimes somebody even brings a cake. One year it said, good luck, morons, in cheerful green frosting. Then anytime between midnight and noon on Saturday, some sources say anytime from 11 p.m. to 11 a.m., other sources talk about it starting on different days. It's a little complicated to give exact details because he just changes it all the time. And again, this is kind of secretive. But apparently one thing that is pretty consistent is Lake will blow a conch shell, which signals there's an hour until the race begins. For a couple of years in the 2010s, he blew it shortly after 8 a.m. But in 2013, apparently he blew it at 1:04 a.m. I mean, that the runners were not able to catch sleep. Any sleep that night before the race began, or not much. It's just madness. It's insanity. As the runners gather near a yellow gate, once he's announced the race is starting, Lake will tell them that nobody's going to blame them if they drop out now. After a little bit of ribbing, his tone will shift. He will say a few words about members of the Barclay community who have passed away since the previous year, if any have. I want to read their names because they're not here with us today, and they're not going to be here with us again, but a little bit of them is out there, he said one year. After that, it's about time to begin. There is no cry of go, no sharp call or whistle. Instead, the official start time is when Lake lights the kind of ceremonial cigarette, and then the punishment begins. Over the years, the course has changed and been given different nicknames. An area known as Testicle Spectacle is the really first climb some years. It's usually pretty overgrown with saw briars and plants that a runner has to bushwhack through. It can easily turn into a muddy river if the conditions on the mountain are at all rainy. Oftentimes, then a runner will head down to a place called Meth Lab Hill. Those who make it to Loop 3 on some years have had the privilege of experiencing Checkmate Hill, which is 1,300 feet of climbing in a quarter mile. If that's not bad enough, Lake has somehow convinced the Brushy Mountain prison warden, or he somehow convinced him in 2009, the year the penitentiary finally closed, or penitentiary, to show him a tunnel that went underneath the old exercise yard of the prison. It's a quarter mile long with no lights and water flowing through it. And of course, that has stayed in the race. During all this, the runners have to find the books. They have to tear out their given page numbers. That has stayed. At first, Lake had to go to bookstores to find the right material for the race, but then people started to send him books to be used in the race. These are some good ones. His favorite in 2013 was titled, What to Do When You Feel Lost, Alone, and Helpless. Other titles for that year included Death Walks the Woods, Heart of Darkness, A Time to Die. Previous titles have included What Did I Do Wrong? Confessions of a Virgin Sacrifice. You Can If You Think You Can. How to Survive and Grow Richer in the Tough Times Ahead. Oh, this is so good. If a runner decides they've had enough, Lake will play taps on the bugle for the loser as they make their way down to the park, specifically so other losers can wake up from their recovery rest and see who else couldn't hack it, he says. For the winners, Lake has later said, the prize is that you get to stop running. In 2014, the documentary film The Barclay Marathons, The Race That Eats Its Young, was released, covering the 2012 edition of the race. It's now on YouTube if you want to watch it. It's almost exactly an hour and a half long. And check out how it opens.
You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. Coming up in the programme, we're going to be talking to the founder of an endurance race so tough, hardly anyone has ever finished it.
You always have to keep people a little off guard.
First rule of Barkley is don't talk about it. If you talk about it, then you're not going to be part of it.
So it's kind of secret.
It kind of weeds itself out. If you belong here, you would find out how to get here.
This is about you by yourself against all that out there.
This is wild. I've never heard of an event like this, like an athletic event. That year, a whopping three people finished. Brett Mann, a returning runner who had finished the year before, now beat his score of 57 hours, 13 minutes, ran at the current record of 52 hours, 3 minutes. Jared Campbell also finished along with John, no idea how to say his last name, Figueresi. There wouldn't be three winners again until 2023 when Aurelian Sanchez, returning finisher John Kelly, and Carol Sabe all finished between 58 and 59 hours in. The next year would see a whopping five finishers, the most the Barclays ever had, including British runner Jasmine Paris, who became the first woman to complete all five loops within the time limit, finishing the event 99 seconds before the 60-hour cutoff. That's awesome. I saw a picture of her. She looked like she was about to die. Early this year, back in March, nobody finished the Barclay. Today, Lazarus Lake, a bit of an unlikely hero. Among ultramarathoners, particularly abroad, he has become kind of a counterculture icon. While in the U.S., he's considered, quote, a bit of a homeless person, according to himself. Indeed, most people don't seem to know kind of what to do with this guy. He's the kind of guy who would and has pulled out his own teeth because he didn't want to go to a dentist, even though he has money to go to a dentist. The kind of guy who eagerly embraces the brutal reputation of the marathon he created, but has also written a touching four-part book series about his rescue dog, Big, called Big Adventures, The Big Dog Diaries. His life goal involves being a kind of sadistic jigsaw figure, but he's also a married man who's worked as an accountant, designed, built his own house, specifically with dorms to house runners he tortures. He's estimated to be in his late 60s or early 70s. Nobody knows exactly. In 2018, he walked from Rhode Island to Oregon. Why? He just wanted to. Runner's World magazine interviewed him about that, publishing an article titled "The Barkley Marathon's Creator is Walking Across the Country. Just Don't Ask Him Why." During his interview over the phone, he said, "The most exciting day is always today, and the most interesting place is always where you are. The world is very different at walking speed. It's been an adventure every day." Before he set out, his doctor told him he wouldn't be able to make it. Of course, he ignored that, and he did. He walked from roughly 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. each and every day. It took him a little over 4 months. At 7 p.m. when he stopped, he would grab something to eat and then head to bed as quickly as possible after dinner, make sure he got his mandatory minimum of 7 hours of sleep in. He would start off each and every day with a Dr. Pepper, of course. Cincinnati-based ultra runner Harvey Lewis, who won his second Biggs Backyard Ultra in 2023 by running 450 miles, what the fuck, in 108 hours, said he smokes and drinks Dr. Pepper all day and has a bit of a belly, but he can walk further than anyone I know his age. On his trek across the country, he didn't take sightseeing detours, stuck to his plan, even if it was like an enticing opportunity. Also, apparently drank a lot of milkshakes. He said he prefers milkshakes from local stores to those from chains. This guy is so unique. Talk about marching to the beat of your own drummer. This guy's truly one of a kind. Last year, he was interviewed by Run Outside, some journal, and the journalist Dan England said that his sense of humor is so dry that you wouldn't know he was joking if he didn't punctuate certain statements with a maniacal cackle that would scatter a herd of deer. He gave the interview while taking his daily 6-mile walk that starts and ends at his house in the woods of Tennessee. Unless he's traveling, he does that walk every single day. He said, "I am not a day off kind of guy. I really think getting outside every day makes you a happier person." His wife, Sandra Cantrell, said in the same article that she doesn't understand why anyone would think of her husband as a sadist. He simply loves offering people a challenge. In fact, as hard as the Barkley is now, Sandra believes he would relish the challenge himself if he was just a bit younger. He would love it, she says. She said he's a little misunderstood, but also He's too old to care. A friend of his, John Kelly, a three-time finisher of the Barkley Marathon, says, I've described him as the exterior of a badger and the heart of a golden retriever. He's certainly a special individual. He's really in this just because he enjoys it. What's greater than that? Again, what an interesting dude and such an interesting part of a fascinating community. Many recent runners say that they don't run the Barkley out of any desire to push themselves to their physical and mental limits. They do it to honor the legacy at this point of Lazarus Lake and to keep the wonderful Barkley community going strong. So, would you join them? You want to run this race? Or is hearing about it plenty? And that's it for this edition of Time Suck, Short Suck. Oh, hearing about that is 100% plenty for me. I would fucking die in that thing. If you enjoyed this story, but I would want to watch maybe some other people run it. If you enjoyed this story, check out the rest of the Bad Magic catalog. Beefier episodes of Time Suck every Monday at noon Pacific time. New episodes of the now long-running paranormal podcast, Scared to Death, every Tuesday at midnight. With two episodes of Nightmare Fuel, some fictional horror thrown in each month. Thank you to Sophie Evans for her initial research. Thank you to Logan Keith polishing up the sound of today's episode. Please go to badmagicproductions.com for all your Bad Magic needs. Happy holidays, and have yourself a great weekend.
Bad Magic Productions.